time for The Outspoken Cyclist, the weekly conversation about cycles, cyclists, travel, trails, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. WJCU broadcasts and streams The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show at 8 a.m. every Saturday morning. In Northeast Ohio, tune in to 88.7 FM, or worldwide, listen in at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for November 28th, 2020. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving and perhaps even got a chance to go out for a ride this week. I have a great show for you this week, and I hope you're going to enjoy it. There's always a lot of anticipation for the books, magazines, and bicycle components that come out of the prolific mind of Jan Hein. The winter edition of Bicycle Quarterly just rolled off the presses, and his fourth book, The All-Road Bike Revolution, has just been published. In the foreword to the book, Ted King says, and I quote, "Jan has one of the most inquisitive and scientific minds toward the bicycle," end quote. And today, Jan and I unpack some of his thoughts and ideas about a wide variety of topics. Jan's belief is that we should all be able to ride when, where, and what we want, comfortably, reliably, and fast. After we speak with Jan, we're going to review Wahoo's Element Rival GPS Triathlon Watch with product manager Abbas Naqvi. If you swim and run, and even if you bike and don't use a GPS computer, there's so many features of this watch that just might make it the best holiday gift for someone else or for yourself this gift-giving season. So let's head on up to Seattle and speak with Jan Hein. Hello, Jan. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this Thanksgiving weekend. How are you?
I'm doing great, Diane. Thank you for having me today.
Well, this is sort of an auspicious time. It's just in time for the holidays, and we have a brand new book from you, which is pretty exciting. This is like your fourth book, I believe.
It's the fourth book, and each book takes longer to write and to produce and so on. So they're coming out in how to say, longer intervals than ever.
Well, a lot's happened since you and I last spoke. I want to make sure we do talk about the book. It is titled The All-Road Bike Revolution, and we'll let listeners know how to get a copy before we sign off today. But I'd like to start with your perspective on 2020, because you have sort of two unique perspectives, one from a sort of supplier position and the other from a retailer, meaning you can sell directly to the consumer. And I'm wondering how Bicycle Quarterly's been doing and how Renee Urse is doing. I mean, I would hope things are pretty good right now.
You know, it's been a challenging year, but considering everything else is going in the world, it's really difficult to complain. We're all healthy. We're doing well. It's been very unpredictable. I mean, at first in the spring, as you know, the economy sort of collapsed. And of course, that affected everybody. But then there was sort of a bike boom where people couldn't really travel. And a lot of people refurbished old bikes and saw all these wonderful old almost bike boom bikes back on the road. And we, I mean, as a high-end company, we're not as affected as most because our customers ride all the time and they buy parts for their bikes all the time. And we've seen a little upswing in Bicycle Quarterly just because people read more and, you know, want to get away from the news to some degree sometimes and just turn off their screens and sit down with a great magazine and just immerse themselves so that they're refreshed to, you know, become involved afterward. It's not really escapism. It's more just recharging.
Oh, that's a good way to put it. I like that. And I did see that the new issue of Bicycle Quarterly, the winter issue, just rolled off the press. So I'm anxious to see that when it gets to me. And I do appreciate you sending me a sort of a preview of the book. I have the book. So if anybody else has not gotten his or her book yet, I think it's on its way if you pre-ordered it. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about supply and shortages. Are you seeing that you have longer lead times to get things that you sell, and in turn, longer lead times to get them out the door?
Well, the lead times manufacturing things are always quite long, and we don't produce things in China just because there are no suppliers who make the parts that we need there. So we weren't affected by the big shutdown earlier this year, which really created some havoc in the bike industry. Our suppliers in Japan have really been operating normally, and we had some delays with shutdowns in France, but it really wasn't too bad. I mean, we work with small makers, and even during the shutdown, if it's a 1 or 5 person shop, they usually could work socially distanced, no problem, because there's only one guy in the workshop. So, you know, the high-end parts weren't as affected. The shipping was a little bit crazy for a while, but it really didn't affect too much. Next year looks a little different because I think a lot of this is rippling down through the supply chains only now. You know, we are basically seeing delays now because some of our things are made by bigger factories, like forging is not something you can do on a small scale basis. And those factories are completely booked now because of this bike boom. And so things get pushed back. And I think the next season, 2021, there will be some shortages, not so much affecting us as much as the whole bike industry.
Let me reintroduce you. If you do not know, I am speaking with Jan Hein. He is the editor-in-chief of Bicycle Quarterly. He is also proprietor of René Urs, which supplies some of the most coveted products right now for the all-road market, which is pretty much everything, wide tires. And you have, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about, is how much you've expanded what you offer from when you very first brought in, I think it was tires was the first thing we talked about many, many, you know, like months, if not years ago.
Well, we make the things that we need for our own riding here in the Cascade Mountains, where we are exploring back roads, where we're going on gravel, where we, you know, where we just found that the bikes that existed, especially 10, 15 years ago, just didn't work so well. You had a road bike that worked well on the road. You had a mountain bike that was great for technical terrain. But if you want to cover 100 miles on a gravel road, and to get to the gravel road or gravel mountain pass, you have 50 miles of pavement on each end. You really need a different kind of bike. You need the road bike and the wide tires and the comfort of the touring bike and maybe some fenders, and you need some, you know, clothes and other things. So suddenly you need a bike that didn't really exist, and most of all the parts didn't exist. So we started with the tires because we needed high performance tires that were wider than what you could get back then and probably still can get right now. We branched out into cranks because we wanted compact gears before compact gears existed. And now we offer subcompact gears, brakes, because again, you need, especially if you don't want to use disc brakes, you need rim brakes that fit around the wide tires and the fenders. The fenders themselves, we wanted better fenders. And then companies came to us more or less and said, you know, we think our things fit into your program. So we're a distributor for Bertrude saddles and bags, and for Schmidt generator hubs from Germany, and, you know, things like MKS pedals, Kaisei frame tubes. It's sort of slowly rounding out into a program of things that you can't get elsewhere. So we're not trying to duplicate what other people are doing because we're too busy making the things that they're not making.
Before we take a break, because when we come back, we're going to talk specifically about your new book. Do you see 2021, once things start rolling, once there's a vaccine and all of that, do you see that the bicycle interest will remain as high as it is and maybe expand some more?
You know, that's almost impossible to say. I think generally the bike has been on a slow upward trajectory over the last, 20 years or so. At least here we see more and more people on bikes. And I think that will continue. What the short term, you know, fashions and so on are, I don't really know. And it's hard to predict. Fortunately for us, it doesn't really matter that much. We're pretty steady. We're not interested in fast growth. And, you know, the people who buy our things usually come back because they like them and tell their friends. And so slowly we're taking over the world.
World domination, one of my favorite topics. We are going to take a short break.
Very slowly.
Yeah, right. A slow world domination. I'm speaking with Jan Hein. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Jan about his new book, The All-Road Bicycle Revolution. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I hope you're not just joining me, but you're hearing the second half of the conversation I'm having with Jan Hein. He is the editor-in-chief of Bicycle Quarterly. The new winter magazine is about to, I think it just did roll off the presses. And we're going to talk about
It's about to roll off the press. But yeah, it's, you know, we're working hard on proofs and getting mailing lists together and all that stuff so that it rolls off smoothly.
Yeah, it's always nice to have things work out. And we are talking about his new book. There's been a lot of anticipation for it. It is The All-Road Bike Revolution, Make Your Bike Fast, Comfortable, and Reliable. So Ted King wrote the foreword for your book, and he says that you have, and I will quote, one of the most inquisitive and scientific minds toward the bicycle.
Well, he's very nice.
It's a really nice foreword. I really enjoyed reading it. And even though it isn't real long, it's got lots of stuff in there. So I wanted to ask you to kind of rewind your life a second and tell me what about the bicycle was and is so compelling to you. What is it that keeps you so engaged with what you're doing?
I think bicycles are really unique. I mean, the bike is the only or one of a few. I cannot think of any other machine that becomes a part of you. When you drive a car or even ride a motorbike, you're more an operator because the machine weighs so much more than you. You're moving levers more or less. On the motorbike, a little more, but still, even, you know, a very lightweight motorbike weighs more than twice as much as I do. On a bicycle, I am most of the weight and the interactions are so direct. So to me, a great bicycle feels like an extension of my body. It's like you don't feel it at all. You just look where you want to go and the bike goes there. And when you pedal, you know, you feel a very immediate reaction.
But so scientifically, you go back in the book, when you start the book, you talk about sort of the history of the bike and how it has really not changed in certain ways over all these years, over 100 years.
Yeah, because, you know, our bodies haven't really changed over 100 years either. And we like to think technology moves forward so fast, but just think about it. People landed on the moon 50 years ago. There was a huge amount of progress in the 19th century with the Industrial Revolution and actually with the invention of the bicycle. I mean, when you look at the 1830s hobby horse that has wooden wheels and to push off the ground, and you look at the 1890s bike that looks like a modern bike, has pneumatic tires, chain drives, spoked wheels, all these amazing inventions that we still use now. And the, you know, the 1890s bike looks so similar to a modern bike and weighs almost the same. And it's remarkable. And from then on, we've just been refining things.
True. And you start pedaling it. It's a bicycle. I don't care what it looks like. It could be carbon. It could be titanium. It could be metal at other metal like steel, which is what I think you and I like.
You know, I like them all. I think.
Do you? Yeah.
People often get pigeonholed into these holes and say steel is real or something. But in the end, I think a good bike is a good bike and it's not the material. You can make terrible bikes out of steel and great bikes out of steel. And with carbon, it's the same. And I think that's what the book is about, is sort of look at what makes a great bike. You know, how can we make that bike that makes it feel like an extension of your body, where the bike just says to you, let's go faster. You can pedal a little harder. Not because you want to beat somebody else next to you, not because you want to compete, but because you want to feel the joy of just flying along.
That's exciting. Just that idea. Because it's true. I think from the time you're small and you first learn to ride a bike, the first thing you think of, wow, freedom. And then that continues to grow as you continue to ride. You know, it's always getting on the bike and being by yourself. Even if you're with a group, it's you and the bike and off you go. So I wanted to ask you what the definition, your definition of an all-road bike is.
Oh, it's actually quite simple. It's sort of a road bike with white tires. It's a bike that combines everything that you want on any kind of road. So, you know, road bike traditionally was a bike for smooth surfaces and often relatively short distances and very high speeds. And it didn't really come into its own unless you had all those factors combined. And the all-road bike with the wide tires works on any road surface. I mean, it doesn't work well in mountain bike terrain where you have technical single track. But for what most of us do most of the time, but the all-road bike is the bike that can do it all. It can even carry a camping load if you put the load on the front wheel where the wheel carries it and not the frame. And so you can do 95% of what you'd ever want to do on a bike if you have a great all-road bike.
I think that what we used to call, and this goes way back over 40 years, that we used to call a bike with 32-millimeter tires. In those days, it was 27 by 1 1/4. We considered that sort of a touring bike or a sport touring bike. And now today we're talking much wider tires, but you have a philosophy about tire width and speed, which I think we talked about it last time we spoke. But I'd like to talk about a couple of other pieces, parts of the book that I like, the topics I like. Fitting is one. Tell us a little bit about your philosophy on the most important aspects of fit from your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, we're of course not talking about how to fit the bike to your body because I don't know what the reader looks like. But one thing that is really important to think about is how, again, the bike and the body interact. And so fitting is not just based on your body's proportions, but also on your riding style, on how much power you put out. When you look at a racer, they are very comfortable in a very low position. And many people think, oh my gosh, that looks so uncomfortable. But what happens is that as you push down on the pedals, your upper body moves in the other direction. So the harder you pedal, the more inclined you need to be to have a counterweight of your body for the pedaling. And that also makes it comfortable because you're balanced. If you try to replicate the racing position, you know, with a casual riding style, it doesn't work because suddenly you're starting to lean on the handlebars and you're basically doing a constant push-up. So I think that's a really important thing for people to think about is where do I fit into the spectrum between the, you know, bolt upright Amsterdam city rider and the racer who is, you know, has the back almost flat. And we all fit in somewhere in between. And that's one reason why many bikes have drop handlebars is so that you can change your position as you ride. You can get lower, you can get higher. If you need a lot of power for a short climb, you often get in the drops, you get really low or you bend your elbow. People do it instinctively. You know, as a bike fitter, you know that you want to put the rider in the middle of that range so that they can go faster and slower without being uncomfortable.
Right. It's interesting when you talk with somebody who's going to become a new rider, somebody who's just getting into riding from when they were probably little and didn't have maybe a bike in between, and you talk to them about the style of handlebars they want. Oh, I want to sit upright. Until you give them the opportunity to see what the options are when properly, you know, sitting them on a bike with drop bars, and then they realize, oh, wait, maybe I don't want to just sit upright. Let me take a moment again to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Jan Hein. He is the editor-in-chief of Bicycle Quarterly. His new book is The All-Road Bike Revolution. It is available now. We'll tell you how to get a copy before we sign off today. We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we're going to speak with Jan Hein some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and if you're just joining me, we are continuing our conversation with Jan Hein about his new book, The All-Road Bike Revolution. I can't wait till we talk about this next topic because I ask everybody about it, but I think you and I are sort of on the same page with it. Let's talk about brakes, one of my favorites. Talk about disc versus rim brakes for road bikes, the all-road bike.
Yeah, I mean, disc brakes are popular for good reasons. Even the lower-end models work really well because they just have to. You know, the disc is so small that if you don't have a lot of power on the disc, you just don't slow down at all. Which means they also work well in the rain. So I think for most production bikes, disc brakes are a really good choice because that's what the industry does and they do it well. But on the other hand, if you have a bike that uses one of the best rim brakes, you get as much power. And often you get better modulation than the disc brake, because the disc brake can be kind of grabby, especially at lower speed. And also, if you keep the bottom of the fork especially free of the braking forces, you can add a little bit of flex, which takes care of vibrations, and so not just makes you more comfortable, but also makes you faster. And that's stuff that isn't possible with discs. So I think both have their place, but as so often, you know, I think the rim brakes really make sense at the higher end, where you have a custom bike or a bike that's really designed to take advantage of all the things you can do with it. Because if you put a rim brake on a bike that has a stiff fork anyway, because it's a lower spec bike that needs, you know, have a lot of stiffness just for the strength of it, the materials are not as high grade or something. In that case, I would say the disc brake is almost a logical solution. And as the disc brakes get better, I think we're going to see almost total market domination, except, as I said, at the custom high end, where, you know, people look at you funny with your rim brakes, but when you ride with them, they're quite surprised how fast you can descend, because you have that really good modulation, because you can feel the braking forces at the rim. They don't get translated through the fork, so you can really feel how much grip you have and all kinds of things.
Part of the problem of the frame when you put discs on, especially the front wheel, that you have to overbuild the fork in a way, which means you kind of overbuild the head tube, down tube, top tube combination. And you're sort of defeating the whole purpose of lightweight.
Well, it depends. If you look at carbon needs to be big anyway. Because you can't make small things out of carbon and be strong. That's why, you know, carbon derailleurs don't weigh any less than aluminum ones, because that's not what that material does well. So if you have a big carbon fork already, it makes sense to put a through axle through it, because you already have all that room. If you have a steel fork and you want to put the through axle through it, suddenly it gets very big and heavy, like you're saying. So I think it's also important to think about the materials and what they can do well, and use the strength of the materials rather than trying to follow some fashion.
You just brought up something I didn't plan on asking you about, but I would like to ask you, and that is some of the new, I don't want to call them innovations exactly, but some of the new specifications that are coming out, extremely large head tubes, wide bottom brackets, big bottom brackets, and of course, heavier duty forks, through axles. And I'm wondering if all of these things are necessary, or are they more marketing?
Yeah, I think there has been a real revolution as bikes moved from metal to carbon, because carbon is more like wood. You saw the same in building construction. You know, you look at a building made from wood or a bridge made from wood, it's got massive beams. And the steel bridge in buildings went the other way, it went to steel. Suddenly you have this, you know, very thin lattice work that holds up amazing things. And so in bikes, it's the opposite way, where the steel bike could be really slender, could be really thin. And all the standards were designed for that. Like, you know, take the bottom bracket. You have a thin axle with a square taper. It's all designed for a steel bike. If you have a carbon bike, you have a huge amount of material down in the bottom bracket area. And so it makes sense to put a bigger hole in that, because the bigger hole actually saves weight. Whereas with a steel bike, if you want the bigger bottom bracket, you have to surround it with more steel, so it gets a lot heavier. And if you have the bigger hole in there, of course, you put a bigger spindle in there. And since you have a carbon fork on the outside anyway, which is big, it all makes sense. If you try to use that new standard with a steel bike, as I said, you put more steel around the bigger spindle, so your bottom bracket shell gets really, really heavy. The metal cranks, aluminum cranks also need to get bigger to get around that big spindle, and suddenly you're defeating the purpose. So I think people need to think about, you know, there's a reason why these standards changed, and changed so suddenly. It's not that the old standards were wrong. It's just that they were for different materials.
I'll buy that. I mean, you certainly know better than me. I just get really frustrated sometimes with having to figure out how many different through axles we need to mount any specific bike in a trainer to do a fitting.
You know, that's just because it's new. When derailleurs came out, every derailleur maker had their own eyelet, and then they made their own dropout. So I'm sure maybe you even remember, because
I do.
You know, the bike boom years where the French bikes couldn't accept Campagnolo derailleurs unless you filed the frames and so on. I think we're seeing that, and eventually they all standardize. You know, now we all use the same, every cantilever brake uses the same bosses. But that's just, you know, one boss. There used to be at least 10 for each brake type. And the same with the derailleur hangers. You know, everybody uses the Campagnolo derailleur hanger, whether it's SRAM or Shimano or even, you know, what are they called, Rotor from Spain, because that's become the standard. And I think we're going to see that with through axles too, where in the future it's going to be, you know, maybe two standards, one for mountain bikes, one for road bikes, and that's it.
Well, I hope you are right, because it's very frustrating at this point. but I understand what you're saying. And you are so right. When I think back, it was like you needed 4 different freewheel boards to get gearing the way you wanted. But the good thing about that was you could take anybody's freewheel and put it with anybody's derailleur and chain, and Suntour would work with Shimano and Shimano would work with Suntour. So, I see both good and bad over the many, many decades that I've been involved with this. I want to just go back to your book for a moment. We have been talking with Jan Hein about his All Road Bike Revolution book. And just to give you an idea of some of the topics, it's the book is 254 pages. It might be a little longer, but that's the last entry is the index. But some of the really interesting topics have to do with things like, I mean, there's bike fit and there's biomechanics and all of that. But he also asks why pro racers ride 25-millimeter tires, which I think a lot of people ask, and mid-trail geometries and unconventional frames and strobes and helmet lights. So you can see that the book covers a tremendous amount of information. So Jan, what have you got left to talk about when it comes to your next book?
Well, I don't know. First of all, I think there's a lot more to discover. I mean, we just tested the bike for Bicycle Quarterly that really surprised us because it was faster than all the other bikes we tested. You know, just allows you to put out more power. We've talked about this planing in the past where the reason, you know, often a touring bike or something is slower is not because it's a little heavier, because you can put water bottles full of gravel on your racing bike and it's still fast. But how the body and the bike interact is something that I think it's still a mystery, and we don't know that much about it. We know that, you know, the stiffest frames aren't always the fastest, that the bike needs to be tuned to the rider's pedaling style, and the rider needs to tune their pedaling style to the bike. And yeah, it's fascinating. I think there's a lot more, and then there's all kinds of other topics. I would love to do a book about the Japanese builders of cyclo touring bikes. There's a fascinating, you know, culture there with so much craftsmanship and so much innovation too, that's been just fascinating to experience. So there are plenty of ideas.
There are plenty of ideas, and I'll look forward to them, but I'm still devouring this book, and it is a book you will go back to again and again. Jan, I'd like to thank you for being with me today. Would you please give us any last thoughts for the listeners, and then tell my listeners how they can get a copy of your book?
Yeah, I mean, I think last thoughts, I'm just so excited. Cycling is getting better all the time. We're discovering more and more, you know, long forgotten gravel mountain passes. And best of all, we're starting to see other cyclists on these beautiful roads away from traffic and really getting back to the essence of why we ride bikes in the first place, you know, just to enjoy ourselves out in nature, take in the landscape and just enjoy cycling. And to get the book, easiest way is go to our website, www.bikequarterly.com, and click on books, or you can probably Google, you know, the All World Bicycle Revolution or Bike Revolution book or something like that.
We will put a link both on our website, on our blog site that houses the podcast download, as well as on Facebook and Twitter. Jan, I have just enjoyed this conversation as I always do. I hope next year we can get back to French Fender Day. That would be fun. We had to skip that one this year because of COVID. I hope you and Natsuko stay well and have a wonderful holiday. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
And the same to you and to your listeners. And thank you. And always nice talking to you.
All right. We'll talk again.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Jan Hein's new book, The All-Road Bike Revolution, is available from bicyclequarterly.com. If you are interested, you can also subscribe to the magazine Bicycle Quarterly. The winter issue just rolled off the presses. And for a limited time, you can also purchase the drawings of Mayoshi, which appear throughout the new book, imposed upon water bottles and a special tumbler. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to speak with Abbas Naqvi from Wahoo Fitness about the new Element Rival GPS watch. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have Bike Law as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. Are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. In the off-season, I swim laps at our local JCC. If you've ever done that, you have probably also lost count of your laps somewhere along the way. Brian thought putting an abacus at one end of the pool was a way of keeping track. I didn't think it would be that practical for me. Then I did try another tracking device that was waterproof. But if I stopped at the end of a lap to readjust my goggles or just to take a short break, the watch lost track and gave me an inaccurate number of laps. But just as I was about to give up and keep counting on my own, Wahoo Fitness, which is arguably the leader in trainers and onboard bike computers, comes up with its Element Rival GPS watch for triathletes. I don't think it misses a thing. And here's product manager Abbas Naqvi to run down the features and some of the thinking behind them. Hello, Abbas. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest on the show this week.
Thank you, Diane. Pleasure to be here.
Holidays are right around the corner. Wahoo announced its newest high-tech product, the Element Rival GPS watch. Now, I'm very aware of all of the Wahoo products until we got to this one. So there were so many features when I read through. I'm like, okay, somebody needs to talk to me about this. Take us through some of the basics of the watch. What's so special about it?
It's important to kind of start off with just saying, you know, again, I do appreciate the time and very happy to be here to talk about the Element Rival. We're very proud of this watch. The team did a fantastic job. And what we really did was to try and find that kind of problem that triathletes, and it is a multi-sport GPS watch specifically for triathletes. So we kind of wanted to do something similar to what we did for the cyclists with the Element line of cycling computers. So when the team started creating this watch, we wanted to really solve a very specific problem that triathletes have. And that's during a triathlon with the multiple legs of a triathlon. You know, there's this term that I actually kind of learned while working on this project myself was something that's termed race brain. So when you're racing, you know, all your effort, all your kind of brain power is really directed towards trying to race and make sure your performance is at that level you need it to be. And a lot of times that's what we're working with, you know, world-class athletes and internal individuals, as well as our, you know, really diverse, large set of Wahooligans. We figured out that when you're coming out of the water after the swim leg, a lot of the athletes forget to press the button, which is to transition to the next leg. And what Wahoo kind of came up with was, wouldn't it be cool if the watch kind of did it on its own? So one of the primary features or the hero features of the Element Rival is something that we call touchless transition. And what the watch does is it has multiple sensors, including the accelerometer, the barometer, and then using GPS speed and a proprietary algorithm, the watch can determine which part of the triathlon the athlete is in. And then when they're transitioning to the next leg, it automatically transitions you to the next leg. Essentially, what the athlete has to do is when they start their race, they press start, they go through swimming, they transition to T1 where they're coming out of the water, they go to their bike, gets onto the bike leg. And then once they get off the bike into T2, the watch transitions to T2. And then when they start running, it transitions to run. And then at the end of the race, once you finish across the finish line, you press the button again and you're done. So you're helping the athlete just focus completely on the task at hand, which is their performance, getting it through the race, and the watch will do everything else for them. So that's really the hero feature for the Element Rival. Now, individually for all those three sports, again, it is a triathlete-focused watch. We support open water swimming, but we also support lap swimming. So when you're swimming in a pool, we have automatic lap detection. So once you are at the end of the pool, it'll detect, you know, if you stop, it'll detect a rest. And then once you go to your next lap, it'll start the next interval. So we also have that. But again, we also provide the capability to our users to do manual laps if they want to. Then for, you know, the bike leg, you can do either outside with, again, using GPS, you can track your workout. Or we have what we call kicker mode, which basically is it connects to any indoor cycling trainer. You can control your trainer. Of course, we have a line of kicker indoor trainers and a kicker bike that's compatible with that. And then if you're running, you know, we do support heart rate monitors. Oh, one thing I kind of skipped on the cycling side, we also support power meters if you have a power meter. And then for running, if you have outside running with GPS, and then also indoor running on a treadmill, so you can kind of track your workout with that as well. So that's kind of like a very quick overview of what this watch is capable of doing.
Wow. Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Abbas Naqvi. He is with Wahoo. He's a Wahooligan, like all the others, I assume. And we're talking about the new Wahoo Element Rival GPS watch. I guess one of the questions I have, since I'm on the cycling side more often than the triathlon side, although I am a swimmer, and you answered my swimming question, which was, right, you know, will it do laps on an indoor pool, is can you use the watch instead of, say, an Element Bolt or an Element Roam?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you for sure you can. So you can use the Element Rival to track your cycling workouts. There are some features on the Element line of computers that are at the moment still unique. For example, plan workouts. You can also do Strava Live segments and routing and navigation. Those are all still unique to the Element line of computers. As we go along, we may add features like Strava Live segments and plan workouts, but at the moment, those are separate for the computers.
Okay.
One other thing that I would like to mention, though, which is also important for me to highlight, is the watch also, the Element Rival also has some unique features when you pair it with a Element computer. So it allows kind of a ecosystem benefit if you have an Element computer. And, you know, kind of in terms of a triathlon, kind of using that as a example, if you have a computer and a Rival, you sync them to your account, they basically recognize each other. You don't have to set them up as individual sensors or anything. They basically know that they're within the same ecosystem. And what you can do is we recognize that having a computer on your handlebars as you're on your cockpit or your bike is a more user-friendly and premium experience to look at your data while you're cycling rather than having to look at your watch. You can do that if you want. But we have another feature called multi-sport handover where, for example, in a triathlon, what you can do is at the beginning of your race, you know, you set up your computer in the morning, on your bike before the race, you turn it on, put it on multi-sport mode. Then you go to the start point for your swim. You start the triathlon activity on your watch. And as you're done with your swim, you approach the bike. There's something really cool happens where the watch Element Rival and the Element line of computers will start kind of communicating and they will know that they're close by and they'll connect automatically. And the Rival will start sharing some data to the computer and start displaying all your metrics on your handlebars so that it's a much more convenient and, you know, premium experience of being able to interact with your products. And then in addition to that, you know, you can set up same thing as we are known for. You can customize pages. You can still use routing. All the basic functionality of the computers is still there. We don't, you know, kind of exclude any of that. And in addition to that, any sensors you may have paired to your computer, you know, which are on your bike, like a power meter or a speed and cadence sensor, all of that data is transmitted to your watch. So while you're cycling, all your data is visible on your computer, but it lives on your watch. And then when you kind of transition away using touchless transitions, you leave your bike in the T2 area and you start running, all that data is still saved on your watch. So at the end of the race, you have one workout that tracks the entire event, and you don't have to like press any buttons really. You can all have it done automatically.
That is just so amazing. Who thought of all this? So how much input do you have? What is your role with Wahoo? Did you develop this watch?
Yes, I am the product manager. So of course, you know, we are a pretty diverse team of functions and roles. But my role is just working with the development side to understand what kind of innovations are available. I also work with our athletes and external parties to really understand and to figure out where are the gaps that exist in the experiences that our athletes have, and then try and connect those dots with those different external parties, athletes, the market, and our internal capabilities, and kind of, you know, try and marry that together to figure out with the team. You know, it's a team effort here at Wahoo to try and figure out what kind of innovation or technology we need to bring to our users to really make it a benefit for them to come to our ecosystem. I think the concept started with Chip Hawkins, who's the founder of Wahoo, and some of the other key members of our team. So he had this idea a really long time ago. And, you know, it's been a few years under development to really be able to make it something that we're proud of and reliable for our users to use.
I've watched the growth of the company, and not so much dollar growth. I have no idea in that department, but just watching the trajectory of where the company has gone and what it's doing. I mean, recently it acquired Speedplay, which makes perfect sense. It's probably one of our favorite pedal systems. So it's just a really interesting company to watch from the perspective of somebody who's been in the business for years and years and years, watching, you know, what happens in the bicycle market. So, you know, we have two more questions, very important. Yeah. One is about the aesthetics. The watch isn't ugly, but it does look big, and I have a little wrist. Is it big on your wrist? I don't imagine it's real heavy, but...
Right. Yeah, so let me make a quick comment about that. And there's also, we do recognize that a wristwatch is definitely a fashion space, because people tend to want to have nice things, and we recognize people who want to wear watches, they want to look a certain way. So there was a lot of work done by the team to make sure that the industrial design of our watch does stand out. So it doesn't look very much like, you know, regular multi-sport watches. It is meant to stand out because of that reason. We do feature a ceramic bezel on the watch as well, which is an industry first. No other multi-sport watch has a ceramic bezel. And, you know, there's a multitude of reasons for that. It's a very scratch-resistant and resilient material, and it also helps optimize our GPS performance for this watch as well. Now, as far as your question about size, we wanted to make sure that the Element Rival was kind of in a sweet spot. So it's not really very big, but it's not small either. It's about 46.5 millimeters wide, which kind of puts it in the middle of some of the watches, sports watches out there. But the cool thing about the Rival is that it's only 53 grams, so it's really light. So although it may look slightly larger at first glance, but when you put it on your wrist, you can hardly feel it. And especially that's really important for triathletes because, again, we want to make sure that the watch helps them perform and it doesn't interfere with what they're doing. So a lot of thought was put into the design of the watch. And in addition to that, we also have Gorilla Glass to make sure that the watch is very resilient, again, to impacts and scratches and things like that. So, again, a lot of thought was put into it. And, you know, it's designed to be able to satisfy a multitude of athletes out there, men and women, and, you know, any type of athlete that we have out there.
Well, it does come in two colors. It comes in black and it comes in white. So I like that.
Yep.
And then, of course, the last question is it available?
Absolutely. You know, when we announced the Element Rival last week, it is currently available direct from our website, or if you visit your favorite bike dealer or bicycle store, you know, and multitude of distributors around the country, you can find it. But yeah, you can certainly buy it off of our website online at any time.
Well, this has just been very enlightening. You know, I see all these things coming out of the Wahoo organization, and this one is pretty exciting. The fact that you've actually focused on this part of the market is also interesting. I think it's probably the first really new innovation for triathletes in this kind of data gathering since the original Ironman triathlon watch, you know, which was just sort of a chronograph, I guess. It's really exciting, right. Abbas. Thank you so much for talking with me about it. We've been talking with Abbas Naqvi. He is the product manager for the Rival watch, the Wahoo Rival GPS watch. You can find it at wahoo.com. What a great gift.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for talking with me. I hope you have a great holiday.
Yeah, pleasure being here. Thank you so much. You as well.
Okay. Bye-bye. If you are interested in knowing more about the Element Rival GPS watch from Wahoo, you can log on to wahoofitness.com for more information. As Abbas said, it is in stock and available now for holiday gift giving. My thanks to Abbas and to Jan Hein for being my guest this week. Next week, we're going to speak with Leah Misbach-Day, who's the co-founder of World Bicycle Relief, to check in with how the pandemic has impacted the lives of those who depend on WBR's Buffalo Bike for transportation, especially to and from hospital. We'll also cover four new tours for 2021 from Adventure Cycling and more. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this week's show. Please remember to rate the show on your favorite podcast app. And if you aren't already a subscriber, how about doing that? I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, stay well. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show, and we welcome your thoughts and comments. We'll be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and most other podcast apps and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.